Financial Sense News Hour with Jim Poplava continues, featuring uncommon news for the wise investor. Up next, commentary and debate about today's financial issues with the experts. Here's Jim Poplava.
There's no doubt that oil production will peak someday, if it hasn't already, and that all other fossil fuels will peak soon after. The important question for investors are, when will it happen, to what extent, and what can I do to capitalize it? Joining me on the program is a co-author of a new book called Profit from the Peak, Chris Nelder. And Chris, you start out your book with a quote from Matt Simmons: this could become the biggest energy issue the world has ever faced. And as you talk about in your opening chapter, in December of 2005, we hit the $1 trillion mark in the consumption of oil. If we aren't at a peak, are we at least close to peak production here, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think we are. You know, essentially world oil production has hardly moved at all in the last 3 years. We've been on basically a plateau since 2005. You know, the models that I respect suggest we'll be on that plateau for another 2 or 3 years before we begin the terminal descent of oil production.
Now, something you stated, which is a problem, when it comes to the energy debate, much of what we see, and especially in the financial press or on cable channels, it's almost like a faith-based rather than a fact-based system. You hear these quotes, we have large oil reserves, for example, in the tar sands, but you know, when you look closer, as you guys have in your book, large oil reserves are maturing, new fields are diminishing in number and size every year. Our energy infrastructure was built on the assumption that oil will always be there when we need it. Sounds like we have a few problems here.
We certainly do, and Matt Simmons, of course, has been very on top of that story and done a lot of work to alert people to these problems. But, you know, essentially, I don't see much growth at all in the oil market even being possible. And we've seen the more important data services like the IEA and the EIA and other agencies have been slowly reducing their targets for what they think oil production is going to look like in the coming years. And at this point, you know, there's a new consensus emerging that we'll be lucky to get to 100 million barrels a day of production, as opposed to the roughly 86 million barrels a day that we're at now. And that's down from 130 in the case of the IEA. So, you know, I think they're slowly backing into the truth that really oil production is just about maxed out. In fact, I'm dubious that we'll ever exceed 90 million barrels a day. I think we're basically there.
Now, I want to have you explain the concept about peak oil. Explain what it means. You know, sometimes people discredit it and they go, we're not running out of oil. And peak oil doesn't imply we're running out of oil, but it does imply we're running out of our ability to increase production. I wonder if you take some time to explain that concept.
Well, you know, the important thing to know about peak oil is it's not about the end of oil. In fact, there's probably at least half of the total amount of oil that will ever be produced yet to go. What we are is out of cheap oil. We've used the easiest to get at, highest quality, cheapest stuff first, and we're getting into the much more difficult, lower quality, harder to produce stuff now, and so that is making it more difficult for us to continue to increase the rate of production. And really, that's what peak oil is about. It's about the rate of production. So from in the past, we generally managed to increase oil production worldwide at about the same, at whatever rate was necessary to sustain world demand, which generally meant an increase of about 1.5 million barrels a day over the year before. But since 2005, that rate of increase has slowed, and we've really struggled to get from a little over 84 million barrels a day up to about 86 now. And it looks to me like we're going to be lucky to maintain production at about the 86 million barrel a day rate before the rate starts to fall. So as the former director of the IEA said, it's not the size of the tank which matters, but the size of the tap. So even if the total amount of oil that we would ever produce were to be increased by, say, a third, it would probably only move that peak rate of production forward just a couple of years.
You know, one of the things you also talk about, this confusion over reserves, as you talked about, and the amount of oil available. Talk about abiotic oil, because there is a theory out there that, you know, there's this thick gooey stuff in the center of the earth and it just keeps replenishing itself.
Yes, it's a chewy caramel nougat in the center, and that's what we all love to hear. You know, I don't know too many geologists that I respect who have any interest at all in this theory. It's mainly one physicist named Thomas Gold who has been a proponent of it. The primary results that he points to are from some Russian studies. As far as I know, under a normal process of scientific peer review, no one has been able to replicate those results, and very few geologists have any interest in the theory at all. Personally, I totally discount it. I don't think it's an interesting theory. I don't think that it survives the scientific peer review process. And until quite a few other people can replicate these results and actually drill and demonstrate that this oil is there to be produced, it has no bearing on anything that we should be worrying about today. And even if it did, that oil would be extremely difficult and deep and expensive and hard to produce. So, because we don't have millions of years to wait for it to bubble back up into the reservoirs that it's allegedly being pumped from today. So, yeah, I completely discount that theory.
I wonder if you might just spend a few moments and talk about the concept of reserve revisions, as you talk about in the book, the various things that you need, and how come sometimes this is often confusing for many investors?
Well, certainly there are many more experts who can speak more knowledgeably on this subject than I can, like Colin Campbell and Jean Larere and Matt Simmons and people like that. But, you know, essentially the history of oil-producing states is such that they increase their estimated reserves over time. In a part, that is legitimate because it reflects the ability of improved technology to harvest more of the original oil in place than would have been possible in years past. So some small part of reserves growth is legitimate. But there's been other reserves revisions that I believe Matthew Simmons calls political revisions, where they've essentially increase their reserve number without having discovered any more oil or without having demonstrated that they have improved access to it now. In the case of OPEC, they've done that because of the OPEC production quotas, where the amount of oil that they're permitted to produce under the rules of OPEC is based on what their total endowment of oil is. So by artificially increasing that reserve number, they're then allowed to pump more oil today, which is what they want in order to sustain their economic goals. So it really had nothing to do at all with the actual oil that was there or their ability to recover it, and it had everything to do with economics and politics. And the same sort of thing, to a lesser extent, has happened outside of OPEC, but, you know, in the U.S., the SEC has very clearly defined rules about how reserves can be reported and recognized on their balance sheets. And that has resulted in a lot more transparency for what the actual reserves numbers are. But using their examples, we're able to make some mathematical models to show how reserve revisions should go over time and to map a rate of production to a total recoverable reserve. And so using those mathematical models and concepts, we can then apply that to the OPEC producers, whose data is completely opaque, unverified, and really we have no idea what the actual reserve number should be as far as whatever they're reporting. But using these mathematical models, we can surmise and we can backdate the reserve revisions, and we can determine what the actual numbers probably are. And it's those type of models that I've particularly focused in on for the book in order to come up with a more accurate sense of what the actual reserve meaning is.
You know, something I've commented on here, and you addressed this issue in the book, Matt Simmons did a major research project many years ago, the world's major oil fields, and you have his pyramid in his book.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's something that people really don't realize, that the gasoline that we have in our car probably came from a field that was discovered 50, 60 years ago. I mean, if you take a look at that pyramid, 47% of our oil comes from just 116 oil fields.
That's right.
14 oil fields produce 20%, and 26 oil fields produce 26%. The other 53% comes from 4,000 odd plus oil fields, and these oil fields are going into decline. And I think that's a problem here.
It's a huge problem, and it's, you know, it's one that you really have to be up to speed on your petroleum geology and knowing all this data to even appreciate. And so, you know, that's part of the problem with educating the public and even doing good media reporting on oil, is that, you know, the literacy to understand this stuff is just simply not there. Really, in fact, I think the only reason why there's finally gotten more attention on the peak oil issue is because the price reached a pain threshold and started to get people's attention. It wasn't because suddenly a bunch of journalists became aware of the data about oil and started realizing what it meant. It was simply the price. But we're going to see that price pain continue to wake up more and more people up, and then we're going to reach these decline rates from these large fields that you speak of, which will result ultimately in lower production and particularly lower exports, which is going to drive the price up further. But yeah, I mean, one of the interesting ways to look at the overall market supply going forward is to look at these mega projects and to look at these large oil fields, fields that produce, you know, at least 100,000 barrels a day, and to look at the drilling projects going forward. And essentially, right now, we can already tell you approximately what oil production is going to be 5 years from now, because it takes so long to bring new fields online, and because the overall production is so dominated by this small handful of very large fields. So essentially, the production of oil years in the future is already written.
In addition to this problem, and here's one I think that really hits the United States hard, exports account for about 47 million barrels a day, a little over 50% of the 85 million barrels we produce. If you take a look at OPEC consuming more of what they produce, very few OPEC countries have been able to increase their production. Where does the excess capacity reside outside of OPEC to increase production? In fact, if you look at who has that ability, you could probably count those countries on one hand. Where does it come from?
That's exactly right. Well, Russia certainly has some undeveloped resources that are significant. However, they're going to be very challenging to produce and slow to produce. And with the hostility that Russia has demonstrated toward the foreign oil majors, it seems like they're probably going to have a hard time developing those oil fields, because they just don't have the knowledge base, the skilled workers, the equipment, and so on, to do it quickly. But, you know, that's one of the few places where there still is some significant oil yet to be produced. Likewise, in the deep water, you know, offshore Brazil, Venezuela, a few other areas in the world. But again, they're extreme oil projects. They're on the cutting edge of oil technology in deep water, very expensive, a very limited supply of drilling rigs available, most of which are booked out several years in advance. It's a long list of factors which are going to inhibit the production from these fields. And so it's going to take a while for them to come online. They're probably going to be slow to wrap up. And, of course, all of that is happening against this background depletion rate from the large producing oil fields that we already have. And as domestic production increases from OPEC in particular, it's cutting into their ability to export. And I thought your son's article yesterday was excellent in the way that it zeroed in on the export question. There's also been some recent models done by Jeffrey Brown, which indicate that, you know, we could see even Saudi Arabia, essentially the world's top exporter of oil, go to zero exports by 2050 just due to its increasing domestic demand. And we're already seeing the top sources of U.S. oil imports, Canada, Mexico, and Venezuela, their export volumes are dropping sharply. So the U.S. is going to feel the pain very soon. Essentially, we already are from a lack of imports.
Fortune did an article, I think it was a little over a month ago. They talked about Saudi Arabia was building four cities. And in those cities, they'll have the world's largest aluminum smelter. They're going to be building refineries. And you talk about this in the book, and the Fortune article talked about it too, that they're beginning to realize as it's getting harder to increase production, you might as well make more money from selling refined products than from just selling crude. In other words, they're almost becoming like the integrated oil companies that we know back in the 70s, like the big oil companies we still think of today.
That's exactly right. In fact, Dave Cohen wrote a very smart article about that called A Paradigm Shift, I believe it was about a year ago, noting that very thing, that the major oil producers of the Middle East were basically moving down the value chain and realizing that there was a lot more profit to be had in the refined products sector, not just finished gasoline and diesel, but petrochemicals and plastics and the whole gamut. Not only that, it's cheaper to send the finished product overseas than it is to ship crude oil. So they're going to keep more and more of those downstream profits.
There's been a lot of projections out there, and especially when it comes to peak oil, you've got the geologists, you got people like Matt Simmons. You also have people out there like Sarah that are very optimistic. But last year, I thought there was a real key report. It came out from the IEA that began to question the supply assumptions it had made. In fact, I think they're studying, like Matt did, the world's largest oil fields and hope to have a report out this fall. But in July of last year, in their medium-term outlook, even they said they see problems ahead.
That's right. And I think the IEA, again, has been slowly backing into this. And once their report comes out in November, most of the world's top decision-makers and governments look to their data for guidance as to what the future of oil production is going to be when they set their policy. So when they realize that the IEA has sharply reduced its expectations for the future, I expect it's really going to shake the markets. And as for Cambridge Energy Research, I have no idea why these people continue to be mentioned and interviewed in the press as if they're energy experts. By my count, their predictions have been consistently wrong for about the last 5 years. Their credibility is shot.
When you take a look at oil today and where they're finding it, I mean, there are very few major oil fields, you know, unless you're looking at maybe Africa, Brazil, and the Caspian. There is some exploration going on in the Arctic, but where's it going to come from?
The future oil production?
Yeah. Where are we going to have the major oil finds that are going to, all these people are talking about? Or I guess what I'm referring to, remember the Tupi find by Petrobras off Brazil and then the Jack field in the Gulf, and this was heralded as super oil fields. But I just don't see too many areas in the world that are large and prolific oil fields as, let's say, what we are currently producing from.
No, I absolutely agree with that. Essentially, I don't believe there are any more rabbits to be pulled out of that hat, you know, of any substance. There isn't going to be some grand discovery of a new, you know, guar or a new canterelle. I just don't believe it's ever going to happen. What we're going to find is smaller deposits that are more difficult to produce and more expensive. And, you know, they're smaller. They're just simply smaller. It takes a whole lot more of them to come up with the same flow rate that one good size find could have. But we haven't discovered a major, like the four supergiants, in, I believe, about 40 years. And that's with the most intensive drilling and exploration and the best technology the oil business has ever had. I just basically don't believe that we should be looking to the supply side for solutions anymore. From now on, we have to start thinking about how we can reduce demand rather than pinning our hopes on somehow increasing supply.
A concept that I think we need to understand here, and I think listeners should too, and that's the concept of depletion. You see these average rates globally that it's around 4.6%, around 5%, somewhere in that area. That average masks a larger depletion rate that in many of the older fields, for example, Canrail, that is running 15 to 20% on some of these older fields. When you look at the top 20 oil-producing countries in the world today, which account for almost 85% of the oil produced, half are in decline.
That's right, and that's even true as you go down the list. You look at the top 10 producers, six of them are in decline. You look at the top 20, 11 of them are in decline, and it goes like that. And you get down to the marginal producers then, and it doesn't matter because the flow rate isn't high enough to be significant. So, no, I think you're absolutely right. You know, the background depletion rate here, especially from these large fields, is what we have to focus on. And that's why just a couple years ago, the background depletion rate was widely considered to be, on average, globally averaged out across all fields, maybe 2.5% to 3%. Then it got up to 4.5%. Now they're saying it's closer to 5%. Next year it could be 7%. So, you know, you have an accelerating decline rate here from these large fields. And that's the background against which all these new, smaller fields are struggling to maintain production. And essentially, I expect that imbalance to increase. So I think essentially we're going to be forced to live with a smaller and smaller energy budget every year once we come off the plateau. And so the plateau that we're going to see for the next couple of years is going to be a mighty struggle of new drilling against that background depletion rate. And then at some point, the background depletion rate simply overtakes our ability to do new production. And that's when the energy budget starts to shrink. And that shrinking will be relentless. It'll go on for the next century.
When you talk about this shrinkage that we refer to as peak oil, we're not going to know it until it passes. And it's a combination, as you talk about, of above-ground factors. The one fact, the national oil companies aren't making the added investments, below-ground factors such as our geological. What impact is that going to have on a country such as, for example, the United States, which consumes, what, 25% of the world's oil and produces only, what, 4% of the world's oil, and we have, what, less than 5% of the world's population?
That's right.
What do we do? I mean, what happens when Canrail goes next to nothing? So we lose imports from Mexico, we lose them from Venezuela, we lose them from Canada and other countries, and our own production going into decline. How do you run the U.S. economy?
On less energy every year, and it's going to be a lot more expensive. You know, we're going to continue. We're going to be in increasing competition with the developing economies of the world, particularly China and India and countries of the Middle East. And those who are net energy producers are going to have the upper hand. They're going to have first pick at their own resources before whatever's left goes on sale to the world market. So the U.S. is actually in an extremely vulnerable position in terms of the economy and how we're going to continue on. And at this point, I don't believe business as usual is even on the table. I think we have to start thinking about aggressively reducing our energy consumption and getting ready for that point when we're going to have to just simply live with lesser and lesser imports every year rather than continually increasing our imports every year as we have been. And that is going to mean an economic contraction right across the board. You know, we're already seeing the effects on the ones that are the most vulnerable to this, the airline industry and the trucking industry and companies that produce things from oil and from energy. Those ones are feeling the pain first. But the next wave will be all the parts of the economy that are on the discretionary side of the economy. Luxury goods, travel, entertainment, and so on and so on. And we're seeing the beginning of that wave now with Starbucks closing lots of stores and contracting its business, with Bennigan's going out of business, with other more vulnerable to the discretionary side of the economy companies contracting. And I expect that to be a long-running process. That could go on for several decades, I think, as the economy gets pared closer and closer to the bone of what's truly necessary, that is water, food, shelter, and essential infrastructure. That's simply going to have to happen because we don't have the energy to continue supporting all this stuff, and the price is going to continue going up.
I want to just talk about the price recently. What was it, May of 2005, when conventional oil peaked, and it's been in decline since then. We've been making it up with coal to liquids, gas to liquids, biofuels, etc.
Yeah, it's a really important point.
And I think it's caught a lot of people by surprise when the price of oil spiked as fast as it has. And yet, when you take a look at this, and I guess what is so disconcerting is from the run-up from 20 to 100, and let's round it off and say 150, almost a six-fold increase in the price of oil, we've had scapegoats. You know, first it was the war, it was terrorism, then it was the weather, it was the oil companies, then it was the dollar, now it's speculators.
Yeah.
And I think on the day you and I are talking, the energy bill is caught in a standstill in Congress.
That's right.
Has it surprised you, Chris, that given the precarious nature that we now find ourselves in as a country, that we're going on a witch hunt, as Matt would say, rather than trying to solve the crisis?
You know, you could call it a witch hunt. You could also call it a snipe hunt. You know, they're out running around looking for scapegoats that don't even exist because they simply can't acknowledge the simple truth that oil production is in decline. And that's, I think, part of the reason why we do focus on the all liquids number, that, which, as you said, masks the real reality of oil production. Actual crude oil has been stuck at around 74 million barrels a day since 2005. And so when we're talking about 86 million barrels a day, that 12 million barrels a day difference is not crude oil. It's other kinds of liquid fuels, including the ones that you mentioned. A lot of it actually comes from the harvesting of natural gas liquids associated with the oil production. So actual crude oil production has been stuck, and in fact has been slightly declining for several years, and it's masked by this extra component.
In addition to some of the other things that we've been talking about, and one I think that is reflects a major wealth transfer and also power shift, and that's this new global order that we see now, the national oil companies versus the international oil companies.
Right.
Also, if you take a look at what's produced out there, sour crude versus sweet crude, I wonder if you might just explain why, you know, it takes more to refine sour crude, and in the case of the United States, we have very few refineries here outside of, let's say, Valero and Tesoro. They have the ability to refine it.
That's right. Well, light sweet crude is more easily made into gasoline with what's called a simple refinery. If you want to produce heavy sour crude, you need other components in your refinery, making it what's called a complex refinery, where you can actually break down these heavier components of the sour crude and remove the sulfur, which makes it sour, in order to produce your gasoline and diesel and other distillates out of it. But yeah, most of the oil business historically has been focused on refining light sweet crude because that was the most desirable, highest quality stuff. And historically, heavy sour crude has sold at a sharp discount because of that to light sweet. But light sweet peaked out several years ago, and you know, the only kind of oil that we can continue to increase production of at this point is heavy sour crude, for which there's a limited global refining capacity. What's curious about it is that here in the U.S., Valero and Tesoro, top heavy sour crude refiners, have seen their margins absolutely wiped out since I wrote the book a year ago. And that had to do with some factors that were very difficult to see coming a year ago, namely the sharp uptick in finished gasoline imports to the United States because foreign refiners tend to focus on diesel. The U.S. is far and away the world's largest consumer of gasoline and a relatively small consumer of diesel, you know, percentage-wise, compared to other countries. So that it effectively drove down the refining margin for heavy sour crude producers in the U.S. So now we are actually in a situation where we have these heavy sour crude refiners in the U.S. running in the low 80s of their refining capacity. They're not running their refineries full out like they typically have because the discount on the sour crude that used to be in place has shrunk enormously, and the margin that should have been available to make gasoline from that stuff has been crushed from the other side by the imports of finished gasoline. So we actually have excess refining capacity in this country now that is not being used because the prices would be significantly higher to make gasoline from that stuff, and we're already reached the point, it seems, where gasoline prices are high enough in the U.S. that it's starting to kill demand. So it's a very difficult and curious situation on the refining side. But yeah, essentially there's mainly heavy sour crude left to produce, and I think actually more and more of that we should expect to be refined outside of the U.S.
As you talk about, and you get into alternatives and solutions in your book, and I want to get to that in a moment, but you look at the current situation that we find ourselves in, there really are no magic bullets. I mean, if you look at the 19th century, it was whale oil, then we discovered coal, and then we discovered rock oil. You hear a lot of talk about technology. Yes, they're making some discoveries in the deep ocean, but there isn't a magic bullet here, is there?
No. The standard phrasing is there are no silver bullets, only silver BBs.
Huh.
And so I think that's about right. You know, what the solutions that we have going forward are going to come from a whole bunch of little efforts. It's not going to come from some bonanza or some of an oil find or some huge new level of production out of hydrocarbons like oil shale. That's just simply not going to happen. The silver BBs that we ought to be thinking about are things like bridging technologies, for example, like plug-in hybrid cars. Even biofuels, so long as they're made with a decent feedstock, not corn ethanol, can provide some sort of a bridging technology. Insulating homes better, increasing efficiency of appliances, you know, all that kind of stuff is what really makes up a big enough handful of silver BBs that you can actually help to resolve the supply-demand equation. But it's not going to be tar sands. It's not going to be oil shale. It's not going to be methane hydrates from the seafloor. All of that stuff, it's just wishful thinking. It's somebody who doesn't understand the concept of flow rates and how long it takes to bring this stuff into production and how incredibly expensive it is, how much water it takes, how much natural gas it takes, whether there is even the necessary supply of natural gas and water to do these things. Like in Colorado, that's definitely a big question mark. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Let's talk about the demand side for a moment. And you talk about the growth in energy demand is based on two factors, the growth in industrialization like we're seeing in India, China, and even Latin America, also the growth in population. And there's a very close correlation between energy demand and population growth. They correlate very closely.
That's right.
And another important factor, too, here that is related that we're also seeing play out here is energy is closely intertwined with food production. And that also has an ominous implication because it takes natural gas for the fertilizers, it takes diesel fuel for the tractors and combines, and it takes diesel fuel to get the crops to the processors and from the processors to the store, and from the store we as consumers drive to the store to buy our groceries. So food is interrelated with this too.
Absolutely. In fact, it's a fairly well-recognized calculation that for every calorie of food that arrives on our table here in America, it took 10 calories of fossil fuel input to bring it to you, all in, from growing it, processing it, transporting it, refrigerating it, etc. And, you know, in addition to all the other things you mentioned, and I'm glad you brought that up, there's all the other sorts of petrochemicals that go into commercial agriculture, from pesticides and herbicides and right on down the line. You know, most of that stuff is made from oil and from natural gas. So, you know, we are looking at a very, very serious situation here, and it's a point that I don't probably emphasize enough because it tends to just make people turn off. It's just too horrible to think about. But I think it's a very real problem, and it's something we really have to talk about. We really have to think about. Without oil production, or at least an ever-increasing energy budget, I don't think it's possible to continue increasing the population of the planet. And as we go into the decline of energy, I expect that we will also have to go into a decline of population. I've seen some interesting models that tried to argue it otherwise, but I see a lot of flaws in them. As far as I'm concerned, energy equals food equals population. And I think we're in the same way that we're at peak oil, we're probably very close to peak food. We're probably very close to peak population. You know, we might get another couple years of increase out of it. We might actually see population increase and kind of overshoot for a short while food production and energy production. But then at some point, they have to come back into balance. And, you know, it seems intuitively obvious to me that a lot of that decreasing population will happen in the parts of the world, particularly the third world, that are the most vulnerable. When they get priced out of oil and natural gas, then they're going to start having shortages of electricity. They're going to not only blackouts, but, for example, shutting down water pumping stations and being unable to continue transporting food and things like that. And so, you know, we could be eventually, especially in the second half of this century, we could be looking at a serious population decline.
In your book, you've got a chapter called The Pentagon Prepares for Peak Oil, and you talk about the Green Hawks have been joined by the military brass, the Council of Foreign Relations, the Pentagon, statesmen, and security-oriented think tanks.
Former secretaries of state right on down the line. And in fact, there was a whole group of those fellows who came out with an open letter to Congress last week with an extremely impressive list of signatories at the bottom saying, hey, people, we need to wake up. We have a very serious energy crisis on our hands, and recommending, by the way, almost exactly the same list of things that I recommend, starting with conservation. They've looked at the data. They understand the geopolitical realities of the energy markets, and they know that there's no supply-side solution to this problem in the offing anytime soon. But for most politicians, it's the kiss of death to talk about declining energy budgets, to talk about economies that have to contract, and you can bet your life that none of them are ever going to touch the issue of population. But those are exactly the things that ought to be first on their lips. If it wasn't considered political suicide to talk about it, they would. And by the way, a lot of the signatories of that letter, a lot of the people who have joined this Green Hawk Coalition did so after they were retired, when they no longer felt compelled to tell a happy story, or they no longer had to worry about losing their jobs if they told the real truth. So, you know, I think we really need to be paying attention to these people. We need to look at what they're saying. We can't just keep disregarding any message that we don't like to hear. You know, that's essentially what got us into this mess in the first place. We have to start paying attention, taking our medicine, and thinking very concretely and seriously about what we can do to adjust to a future of declining energy. And, I mean, you know, it's not all a bad story. Essentially, what we have immediately is a liquid fuels crisis. We're losing access to liquid fuels made from petroleum and natural gas. But we have all this renewable energy technology just starting to increase, which currently makes up less than 2% of the overall energy supply. So as this supply of liquid fuels, and generally really hydrocarbons, fossil fuel starts to decline from essentially 95% of the total energy mix, it has to decline down to about 2% by the end of the century, while the renewable supply has to increase from 2% up to about 98%. So it's got to be a total transformation from fossil fuels to renewably produced energy by the end of the century. And renewably produced energy is electricity. It's not liquid fuel. So we need to really transform our whole infrastructure into one that can run on electricity, electric cars, electric trains, electric-powered appliances, and all this stuff. You know, for those who are in those parts of the market, it's going to be the greatest investment event of the century. It's going to be an unbelievably massive transformation and also a transformation of much of our critical infrastructure. So there's going to be huge opportunity in that area, even as the liquid fuels business goes into its twilight years.
I want to get into that next, because as we witness the twilight of fossil fuels, T. Boone Pickens, who's made a fortune betting correctly on energy, has now got an alternative proposal where he would like to take all the natural gas that we use in producing power plants, turn it into liquid fuels on cars, and then wind and solar to almost produce 20-25%. So he's already got his eye on the ball on peak, if you listen to him. And he said, I'm moving beyond that. I'm moving to where we're going to make money next and where energy is going. So let's talk about how we make money here.
Absolutely. Well, you know, you could do a lot worse than to follow T. Boone in his investments. He's made a lot of very good calls, a lot of good calls in a row. And a lot of the details of what he invests in are public knowledge. And it's fairly easy to build a portfolio around his ideas and just follow him, because he knows this stuff better than most people do. You know, and I think he's absolutely right in terms of the concept of relieving some of that burden on natural gas and replacing it by renewably generated electricity. But at the same time, there are some details of the Pickens plan that I'm still waiting to hear, like how he thinks we're going to go about decommissioning those natural gas and coal-fired plants, no doubt a significant percentage of which are nowhere near having amortized their initial capital cost. So how he thinks we're going to go about doing that, and then how he thinks we're going to do about replacing all these gasoline and diesel-burning engines with natural gas, I don't think that vision is entirely spelled out yet either. But it's an interesting concept, and at least it's the right way to think about these problems. Let's look at what can we offset, what can we replace it with, what can we hope to do in a reasonable time frame. And so for that, you know, I really applaud his effort with the Pickens plan, and I also really appreciate the fact that he's made such a public effort to get business leaders, to get community leaders and politicians and members of the public enlisted in this effort, because it really is going to take a big effort from all of us. I certainly respect his gumption and the sort of strategic way that he's thinking about it. Whether or not his specific proposal is the way to go, I'm not yet entirely convinced. You know, by the same token, I felt that Al Gore's proposal was interesting, the suggestion that we could produce 100% of our electricity from renewable sources within 10 years. I don't think that's possible, not even by a long stretch do I think that's possible. But I think it's the right idea. It's the right direction to go in. I mean, I think, you know, he probably has a shoot for the stars, maybe he'll hit the moon strategy here, which is fine. I mean, we do need to galvanize that level of support and that kind of a really serious, strong push from every level, including the federal level, to really take this challenge by the horns and try to do something about it. So, you know, I respect both those efforts as a way of at least trying to come to grips with the problem in a real and a practical way.
Chris, what this energy situation reminds me in terms of the solution, it almost reminds me of the exam you took in school where, you know, they'd give you a question and the answers were A, B, C, D, or E, all of the above. Isn't E, all of the above, the answer to our current energy situation? Because whether you're looking at continuing to drill, because we're still going to need oil and natural gas, because we're not going to find alternatives overnight. Wind will only work in certain areas, nuclear, now they're working on tide, geothermal, biodiesel. It sounds to me like it's going to be a combination of everything to help replace what we're going to be losing from fossil fuels.
I think that's exactly right. And that's where that concept of a handful of silver BBs comes from. Each one of those things is a BB, and it's going to take all of them together to come up with solutions for this challenge that faces us. It's not sufficient to just lay back and think that somehow the oil industry is going to radically increase production and pull our bacon out of the fire here, nor is it reasonable to think that any other single source of hydrocarbons is going to be that silver bullet. That's just not the right way to think about it at all. It's going to need to be everything. It's going to need to be increased drilling for hydrocarbons for a while, and I hope for a short while. It's going to have to be an increased use of coal. It'll probably rely on increased production of nuclear-generated electricity, although I am one of those who are a bit skeptical about the ability of the world to increase nuclear capacity very significantly from where it is now, and that's for a lot of reasons that we don't have the time to go into now. But, you know, essentially, I think that every little bit is going to count, whether it's on the supply side or the demand side. But we should really be putting our attention on the demand side first. The cheapest watt of energy that you can produce is the one that you don't have to produce at all because you increase the efficiency or because you eliminated losses and waste. And the same thing is true with oil. You know, the more miles we can travel on a single gallon, the better. And that's where the low-hanging fruit is, and that's where we ought to be focusing our energy first, is on reducing demand and improving the efficiency and eliminating the losses and the waste everywhere we can find it. The more we do that, the more we can buy ourselves a little time before the serious decline of energy supply hits us. We can buy ourselves a slightly longer plateau, give ourselves a little more time to adjust, give ourselves a little more time to switch more loads over to electricity from liquid fuels and so on. And that's all going to be a crucial part of working out, you know, how we get our way through the future. But at this point, particularly looking at the stalemate that we've seen in Congress over energy policy, and the fact that we really even haven't had an intelligent energy policy in this country for about 30 years, it really makes one doubt what we're going to be able to accomplish. We need to move a lot faster than this. We need to come up with agreement as soon as we can. We need to stop using energy and energy bills as a way of pushing forward other objectives. I think energy policy ought to be debated and passed and moved forward without any interference from other subjects, other bills, other pork, other objectives of a political nature. That only is going to delay our progress further. We really need to clean up that process, and we also need, you know, serious buy-in and participation from the business sector and from investors to get focused on the solutions and to get focused on efficiency.
Chris, as I look at this, and it reminds me of something that I just feel in as a person that believes in free markets, as we have seen the price of energy going up, instead of the politicians bashing or trying to release our petroleum reserves to bring the price down, the market, in a way, is teaching us to conserve. I live in Southern California here. You're starting to see a lot more Priuses now. You're starting to see a lot more Toyota Corollas, Honda Civics, where a couple of years ago, all you saw was large SUVs in the parking lot. So as prices go up, as leases come due, because a good majority of cars bought in this country were bought on lease because it was cheaper to lease than buy, isn't the market teaching us to conserve?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, essentially, price signals are forcing the right kinds of changes. But that's kind of doing it the hard way. You know, rather than having a nice, smooth transition from SUVs over to more efficient vehicles over the last 10 years, which really would have been a much more ideal scenario, now we have a very small number of car makers trying to satisfy an enormous overhang of demand for high-efficiency vehicles, and we've got lot after lot after lot full of SUVs that nobody wants, that car dealers are just kind of getting stuck with or having to sell at a great discount. People who have invested in those vehicles and go to sell them back to the dealership are getting quoted 30% below Blue Book. So this is going about it the hard way. But either way, it's definitely the right way to go. One way or another, we have to start making that transition. And, you know, I've seen the same thing that you're talking about in Southern California happening up in my area of Northern California. There's been a real transformation of what's on the road. There's been a significantly noticeable decrease in the number of drivers on the road. Congestion is falling. There's been a huge uptick in bus ridership, a huge uptick in Bay Area rapid transit rail system. And I've also noticed a whole lot more people on bicycles. Those are the right kind of strategies. Whatever we can do to reduce our consumption is the right way to go.
Well, I remember something Matt said Simmons when I interviewed him last summer. He said two things. He predicted that energy would be the number one topic by the fall's election, and that certainly that prediction has come true. But he also said, you know, in the end, it's probably going to take a full-blown crisis. I think, you know, when people are upset right now because we're paying higher prices, but you know what? When you can't get it or you have to be in the gas line and it gets to that kind of crisis level, it seems like it takes something like that to get action out of Congress because, once again, the day you and I are talking, they're almost at an impasse here. They can't seem to get around either side coming up with a viable energy plan.
That's right. It's pathetic, really, that we're going about it this way. It's particularly frustrating when you look to examples in Europe, for example, where it hasn't been the kiss of death for them to talk about peak oil, where lots of energy ministers, environment ministers, captains of industry, and so on have been very public and very clear about peak oil and about the future of energy production and very clear about the fact that they have to make a significant federal-level investment into incentives to produce renewable energy, and they have to go ahead and start penalizing hydrocarbons as a way of moving loads away from them. And they've done that in any number of ways, from very significant gasoline taxes, diesel taxes, incentives to install all kinds of renewable energy machines, actually putting a price on carbon emissions, and so on. I mean, those are all forward-thinking strategies that have the ability to modify the market and do so in a fairly structured and measured and controllable way, rather than sitting and dithering around until the pain of price forces us to make changes, in which case we do them too quickly, we do them without enough dialogue, without enough research and discussion and participation from all the relevant parties, and then you wind up with a stalemate like we have now. I mean, it's ridiculous, all the stuff that's being stuffed into the energy bill here, from medical research and child pornography and, you know, all kinds of things in an energy bill. It's like, you know, this is no way to go about crafting intelligent legislation, and it's seriously what we need to do. But at the same time, you know, if the political leaders don't listen to it, it doesn't matter. Representative Roscoe Bartlett, Republican out of Maryland, has stood on the Senate floor, I think of the House floor, about 40 times now and given a lecture on peak oil since 2005. And he really knows his stuff. He knows his data. He's up to speed. He's a scientist. He understands this stuff. He understands the implications of it. He knows all the possible effects from economic fallout to population and so on. And yet he has given this lecture on the floor of Congress about 40 times to mostly an empty hall. His fellow senators and representatives just simply won't come and listen to it. Don't want to know. Don't think their constituents care, or maybe they just simply don't think that they could do anything with that knowledge, and so they try to ignore it and simply hope that when things fall apart, it won't be on their watch. So, you know, we have anything but an intelligent and deliberate process for dealing with the energy crisis and crafting energy policy in this country right now. It's a horrible shame, and I think the blame is equally spread to both parties in one fashion or another.
I would agree with that.
You know, at some point, we have to get beyond the partisanship and start making progress here.
If you were looking out, Chris, having researched this subject, looking out 10 years from now, are you optimistic that we can solve this problem? Or do you think years of delay and bickering as we see going on in Washington now creates a real tragedy here?
I'd give it a coin flip at this point. But I would say that looking at the trends, looking at the way things have been happening the last few years, it's really difficult to be optimistic about it. People are not waking up fast enough. There's this huge tide of denial and misinformation and confusion and, you know, sometimes deliberate confusion and misinformation that's stymieing an intelligent dialogue and making it slower and more difficult for us to come up with intelligent responses to the crisis. We are not on a path of success right now. We are on a path that's going to lead us straight to a Thelma and Louise moment where we find ourselves hanging off into space, having driven off the cliff, and, you know, we don't have a parachute. That's the path that we're on right now. We're going to have to make a hard turn and start changing the way that we come up with solutions, the way that we come up with policy, and the way that we inform the market if we have any hope of achieving some sort of a managed ascent or, you know, I don't even think a soft landing is on the table anymore. It's an extremely, extremely serious challenge, and it's just not properly appreciated yet. And I'm afraid that we're just going about it the hard way.
Yeah, unfortunately, it looks like, I think Matt's going to be proven correct, it's going to take a crisis. Well, Chris, I want to thank you for joining us on the Financial Sense News Hour. Very, very well-written book. I thought it was very balanced. You took the positives, some of the negatives, and also you talked about what you could do on the plus side to profit from it. The name of the book is called Profit from the Peak, The End of Oil, and the Greatest Investment Event of the Century by Brian Hicks and Chris Nelder. And Chris, thanks for joining us on the program this week.
Thanks very much for having me, Jim. I appreciate it.